how do we actually make a more perfect union? It's not through rancor. It's not through animosity. It's not through ad hominem criticisms. It's really through collaboration.
You're listening to Parallax from Radcliffe Cardiology in association with MakeADent.org. Here is your host, Ankur Kalra, MD.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Parallax. This has been in the works for a while. This is with a guest who I consider a personal friend, also sort of a terrific thinking mind that I always want to run things by when I'm at the crossroads, because I think he's very wise and he's very thoughtful and he's very eloquent. Not only he speaks, but also how he thinks. I'm gonna, you know, do something here which is slightly different, is that I'm gonna have him introduce himself, because he just wears many fantastic hats, and he recently got selected for a very competitive leadership program, which he's going to talk to us about, which I think all of us can benefit from. And just learning that that program exists, I think what is important is for us to know that a program of that caliber exists for any of us to apply, in case, you know, any of us are interested in leadership positions. So with that introduction, Shashank Sinha is my guest on today's show. And Shashank, welcome on the show, and thank you so much for doing this for us.
Well, Ankur, truly my honor and privilege to be here. Thanks so much for having me. I'm an advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist at Inova Heart, Shar Heart and Vascular at Inova Fairfax Medical Campus in Northern Virginia. I also serve as the medical director of the cardiac intensive care unit and the director of the cardiovascular critical care research program. From a research standpoint, I have the pleasure and privilege to serve as a steering committee member for the cardiogenic shock working group. I'm also a former steering committee member of the Critical Care Cardiology Trials Network. Alluding to the program you just mentioned, I have been selected as a 2024 Presidential Leadership Scholar.
Well, excellent. Fantastic. So Shashank, I think it's a good segue for us to actually discuss the latter part of your introduction, you know, which you just shared with the listenership. Tell us more about that leadership program. Why don't we start there?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the Presidential Leadership Scholars Program is a leadership development program started by Presidents George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and then the foundation or center for Lyndon B. Johnson. And the goal is actually to bring together, in their own words, bold and principled leaders who are committed to facing critical challenges, both at home and around the world, and exploring the lessons learned during the administrations of those presidents. The intent is mainly to take a very diverse group of mid-career career professionals. And each year they do select a group of us in healthcare to participate. And it was truly my honor and privilege to both apply, interview, and subsequently be selected for the program. And this past week, I just completed my third of six modules for the program, and am halfway through and have a number of reflections on the process so far.
My first reaction is, wow, you know, what an opportunity for any individual in any field. You know, healthcare certainly is an important, career path, but I think it overall, you know, what an opportunity to, sit in those rooms and have those conversations with, you know, the leaders, of our country. Shashank, what made you even apply for this opportunity? You know, so two questions here. The first part is, how were you made aware of this opportunity, and what was the impetus that then drew you forward to apply for this program?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I first learned of the opportunity when I read about it about a decade ago in Time Magazine when the program was initially installed by those former presidents. I was very curious about it. Certainly, I was very much in the midst of my cardiology fellowship training, and so I was in no position to even think beyond those terms. But I knew that it would be of interest if the opportunity would certainly present itself. I think the impetus to get to the second part of your question was really driven largely by my experiences during the COVID-19 pandemic. And thinking critically about what were the lessons that we needed to learn as a healthcare system, in particular in caring for the sickest of the sick, not just with heart disease, but the most vulnerable and critically ill patients who demand time-sensitive care that needs to be coordinated across multiple hospitals and multiple providers and multiple health systems. And how can we better learn leadership from other sectors outside of healthcare?
Yes. So, Shashank, great answers. And, I think, I know you know that I have that philosophical, spiritual bent. And there is a lesson that I've learned here from your story that you've shared. And I sort of want to impress that upon the listenership, and that is that what Dr. Sinha just shared with us was him reading about that opportunity a decade ago and essentially sort of subconsciously meditating on it for a decade for it to manifest. So I think, Shashank, the seed that you were going to have this opportunity, the seeds were planted a decade ago. And I think in some way, shape, or form, subconsciously, and this is from Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow, a lot of the decisions and we make in life and a lot of the paths that we take in life, whether it's personal or professional, those seeds are planted in the subconscious. When you read about this opportunity, I'm sure it was something you wanted to pursue back then, as you shared with us, were you then looking at what the calendar was for this opportunity, on a cyclical fashion? And did you sort of time it in a particular way, based on where your career was progressing? Or was that something which just was an impromptu decision when you saw the opportunity present itself again?
Yeah, it's a great question. The simple answer to it is no, I wasn't very strategic about sort of when I would apply. I consider myself sort of a student of leadership, and like yourself, just have an insatiable, curiosity and thirst for knowledge. And I, felt first and foremost that it was important for me to develop fundamental leadership skills, which I had the privilege of learning through both the American College of Cardiology's Leadership Academy, some institutional leadership development programs, my master's program in health and healthcare research at the University of Michigan under one of my mentors and now coaches, Tony Tsai, who's at the University of Utah. But I think what really inspired me to pursue this was to be at a stage of my training where I felt I needed to think beyond my current stage of personal and professional development and explore potential synergies, collaborations, solutions that may be truly outside the box. Einstein had a great adage that I often try to pay heed to, which is we cannot solve problems using the same thinking that was employed at the time that we created them. And so I do think it behooves us to have these structured serendipitous interactions with leaders outside of healthcare and see how they address and examine problems that at the fundamental root of it do, especially as it pertains to systems, care delivery, care processes, are are fundamentally problems of human organization and behavior, and so may have some common threads.
Yes, and Shashank, you mentioned about the modules. Now, is that something that is sort of a run-in phase prior to you starting the program?
So it's actually deeply embedded into the program. So the program itself occurs over a period of 6 months, typically from January to June every calendar year. I'm fortunate to be in the ninth cohort of the program. There are currently about 480 alumni, 60 members each class, starting with the original class, I think back in 2015. And the alumni community, while small, is very active and robust and deeply engaged. And I've been truly humbled and grateful to receive all the support from former alumni of the program all throughout the world, who've reached out, professionally to, connect and, to open up their networks and opportunities. But the program itself, from a curricular standpoint, is six modules. The first one, at least for my cohort, begins in our hometown here of Washington, D.C. Did include a tour of the White House, which was very awe-inspiring, and some time at Georgetown University. And then subsequently circles through each of the libraries or presidential centers for each of those respective presidents. So module two was with President Bill Clinton in Little Rock, Arkansas. Module three, which I just completed, was with the administration officials who now celebrate the legacy of President George H.W. Bush in College Station, Texas. The upcoming module, module four, will be with George W. Bush in Dallas, Texas. And then module five with LBJ and his presidential library in Austin, Texas. And then module six, or sort of capstone, is actually in Philadelphia, going back to our historical roots and origins.
Yeah. Wow. Fantastic. Shashank, in going through these modules and interacting with some of the other alumni of the program, I mean, sort of did the math quick, and this is probably year nine if you have 480 alumni and you have 60 per class. So that's eight classes. And then are you the ninth cohort? So across the spectrum of, these many years and all these individuals from different professional backgrounds. Again, a two-part question. One is, what are the similarities in terms of the vexing problems that we face in healthcare that you've encountered in other spheres? I mean, let alone cardiology. I mean, I'm talking healthcare broadly here, because it is my assumption that the program administrators are going to view this broadly as well, not only cardiovascular medicine, but healthcare in general. Because, obviously these problems are entrenched and we just see a facet in cardiology. And then, the second part of the question is, in parallel with the problems that you may have identified, which are similar in other professional spheres, are there common solutions which intersect, at these different broad specialties? Is there a common intersection where we can come up with innovation? Because that's where innovation will happen, is when different fields collude to come up with a solution. So that is my question.
Yeah, great questions. And I'll try to take each of them in turn. So yes, there are some similarities. And I think it's because the fundamental theme from an academic standpoint for this leadership development is that leadership can be taught. There may obviously be those who are born with certain intuition or skills with respect to either public speaking or leadership, but leadership is something that we do, and ergo it is something that can be learned and taught. And the four core leadership skills that the program is designed to cultivate are across these categories: vision and communication, strategic partnerships, decision making, and then persuasion and influence. And you can see that that likely resonates across both public and private sectors, business, law, medicine, and so forth. And the goal is to essentially learn both the principles and potential frameworks, theoretical and applied, that may be of utility in helping us grow as leaders in our respective fields. One of the key goals is for each scholar to have a personal leadership project to which we devote our time and attention to. And it may be at various stages. It could be all as early as ideation, some in sort of more the implementation and execution phase, and some nearing completion of that project throughout that 6-month module. But many will, you know, continue that well beyond when the program ends in June of this year. And for me, it's really been an opportunity to think very critically about cardiogenic shock, which is an area of both clinical and scientific interest to me personally, a highly morbid and lethal disease with, you know, up to 50% mortality that has up until recently been relatively unchanged. And to think critically about what we can be doing from a systems of care standpoint to get better. And again, caring for the sickest of the sick with heart disease. And so I've been very excited to learn from colleagues and from faculty on how to, you know, A, think about bold, ambitious collective endeavors, but B, you know, to actually execute, because ideation is, of course, only the first step.
I mean, I would just be enticed to be a fly on the wall, you know, in all those places that you just mentioned when you were discussing as to what the curriculum entails. Shashank, I'm going to take a step back because, you know, I think this is going to be important for the listenership. And that is that I didn't specifically ask you about the application process for this opportunity. So if you want to talk to us about what that entails, you know, in case any of the listenership members are interested to pursue this, What are timelines? What does the application entail, you know, in terms of the components of the application? And when do you hear? And then what are the time requirements for of engagement, you know, good engagement with the program? Because, you know, I'm sure, I mean, I know you work for a health system which is busy. So how does it entrench in a busy clinical practice for some of the busy clinicians who are tuning in and listening to this?
Yeah, sure. So the application typically opens up in the late spring, early summer of every calendar year. You can actually go to presidentialleadershipscholars.org /apply and learn more about that sort of cycle. And you can actually even sign up for updates to be given a reminder as to when the application opens. The specific criteria that they outline are as follows. They're looking for civically minded citizens who are open to feedback, are accepting of diverse points of view that's vitally and critically important to them, who have meaningful professional experience. And the breadth and depth they're typically looking for is at least 10 plus years in your clinical practice to build on the programmatic experience and have an established record of engagement and leadership as well. It's not designed as sort of an introductory course. And then have a position of influence to actually implement the changes those scholars seek if they're selected. And then to your last point, can fully participate in a rigorous and intense 6-month program. And so, to be honest with you, I actually applied to this program a year prior, and was selected, and actually was notified on Thanksgiving Day of 2022. And had to respectfully decline the opportunity. There's no deferral that's actually allowed, because my wife and I were in the midst of a high-risk pregnancy for her. And I did not think I could fully commit and engage in the program as needed to at the time. Luckily, everything went well. I'm proud to report I have a happy and healthy one-year-old daughter named Sophia, whom you've met recently. That time element is vitally important for those considering the program, because while there may be extenuating circumstances, no deferrals are granted. And so I did have to formally reapply the year after, and luckily was reaccepted.
So you reapplied in 2023, and you were, because I remember you sharing this about the same time last year, correct? Around Thanksgiving last year is when you shared it?
Correct. And that's typically the notification. So programmatically, applications are due somewhere around, I don't want to hold to it, but somewhere around early July. And then interview invitations are extended in the early fall. And then decision notifications are usually early winter, in the sense of late November, early December. And the reason for that is that the program formally begins in January of the following calendar year. And so you actually need institutional buy-in from your program that you can participate. It more or less resonates with sort of an executive MBA style, you know, 1 week, one kind of Wednesday to Saturday or Thursday to Saturday out of every month that you're committing to it. And so I had to rearrange my clinic schedule, for instance, and my service blocks so that I could accommodate the program.
Yeah, that's a lot of planning. And that's, again, you know, require institutional buy-in for you to be able to do something as involved as this program for 6 months. Shashank, what are the insights, the early insights? I know you're still in the middle of this, but what are the insights that you've garnered thus far, and, you know, someone like yourself who's, you know, if you were to ask me, I consider you a leader already, and that's an effective one, you know, and you serve on the editorial board for an influential journal in heart failure and cardiac transplantation. You are leading clinical services at your organization. You have in the past led several fellow in training leadership positions within the American College of Cardiology, as well as with the prestigious Journal of the American College of Cardiology. So as far as I am concerned, I mean, you've been sort of the bona fide leader for years on end now, you know, having worked closely with you, actually having co-authored a paper with you as well on learning health systems, which, by the way, I did not share this with you when we were together at your place in DC. That paper is in the curriculum for London School of Economics Executive Master's Program. I think you should put that in. I think you should put that on your resume. I think I should too, because I mean, I was like, whoa, this is pretty neat. So, you know, but back to my question, what have you learned which I think has further expanded the horizon of your leadership skills so far?
I think leadership, like any discipline, is a craft that requires discipline and consistency and commitment. You know, in speaking with, you know, President Bill Clinton, for instance, in Little Rock, Arkansas, who graced us with a several hour dinner, he reminded us how important our civic duty as citizens are to really serve one another, and to really think about the Constitution of the United States. How do we actually make a more perfect union? And it's not through rancor, it's not through animosity, It's not through ad hominem criticisms. It's really through collaboration. And I really give you a lot of credit for this podcast and this forum in trying to think about that other point of view. And that's probably been lesson number one, two, and three for me, which is when I feel like there is either a critic who's diametrically opposed to either my train of thought or what work I'm trying to achieve, to really try to understand their perspective. You know, what one of the presidents who's not part of the program, but I think is widely revered, you know, former President Lincoln, I think said it best. I do not like this man. I must learn. I must get to know him better. Right. And if we could really heed that wisdom in today's world, I think it would really do us all well, as opposed to sort of, wallowing in our own echo chambers. I do think it is important for us to think about what are the common threads of humanity and of being fellow Americans that truly do unite us. The second principle really is that, compromise is possible if you're willing to have, mutual interest in trying to serve together. In other words, interest-based negotiation and bipartisan solutions and collaborations are absolutely essential to no matter what endeavor in life we're in. It's very rare that, for instance, even our scientific work gets accepted unedited. I know you've had that good fortune before, but most of us, require obviously a rigorous peer review and edits that don't make it into some chimera, but actually do strengthen the overall content of what we're trying to create together. And so that, I think, has been another important leadership lesson, is to always think about co-authorship. Not co-authorship in the way that we think about it scientifically, but co-authorship in what we're doing here. It takes two of us to have a conversation. It takes many of us to be able to create something, whether that's what we do clinically, scientifically, teaching, which is a big part of, I think, the responsibilities that we both enjoy. You're always co-authoring. Even when you're parenting, you're co-authoring, not just with your co-parent, but with the child itself. And so I think being cognizant of that, and as you've eloquently stated for your podcast, Parallax, what is that other view? And how do I really discern what the rationale for it is? And the common refrain that many of the former leaders in office have taught me is, tell me how you came to that conclusion. Help me understand your thought process in a genuine invitation. And I think if you're willing to do that, then what is seen as often obstinate or recalcitrant, we really can find some common ground and try to move, forward. And I do think that is ultimately what the program is looking for, and what we as a nation are looking for is, those core values that truly define us. How do we find the commonality there and build a more perfect union?
Yeah, no, I wish I could speak like you, Shashank, but I can't. that's very, very eloquently put together and very beautifully explained. I'm gonna, the fact that we have you here with us and, use this as an opportunity, because I'm sure you as with being on service and, interacting with colleagues, with patients, with trainees, I'm sure you've dealt with situations of conflict. And that conflict could be around a clinical decision, and that conflict could be around expectations from family members or expectations from patients. That conflict could be, on a manuscript when you're mentoring a trainee to write one. And, you know, some conflicts are really hard to resolve. I think in part also because there is fear. You know, I think either you are fearful or the party that is involved is fearful. And I think each time we are trying to resolve a conflict from a place of fear or from a place of preconceived notions without an open mind, sort of like an armchair opinion, we predispose ourselves to make fatal mistakes. From someone who's been entrenched in several leadership roles, like we discussed, and now going through such a beautiful training program, how do you approach conflict, Shashank? How do you untangle the preconceived notions and biases that you have? How do you keep them aside? And then how do you enter the room with a completely open mind? And I know as superfluous or as cliched as it may sound, you know, and it's interesting that I've used both those words in one sentence. I do think that to some extent it's true. I mean, it's true to keep your preconceived notions and biases and what you've heard from other people on the side and approach any individual or any situation with an open mind and discern for yourself what is perceived truth or truth, absolute truth. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, I mean, what a great question. And we could probably spend the entire hour and then some discussing it. You know, I can't even pretend to say that I have any degree of mastery on conflict management. Again, as a student of leadership, I would say I'm a student of trying to understand how to improve, you know, conflict resolution or management. And, you know, I'll share with you a couple of things I've learned through experience and with great humility, which is one, anytime you approach a crucial conversation, it is important, just like we say in running a code, you have to check your own pulse. I've never known a conflict to be resolved without having some degree of aplomb or equanimity or being, as the expression goes, cool, calm, and collected. But that's much easier said than done. In fact, you know, there's a great line from one of my favorite books, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, that says, between stimulus and response lies a space. In that space lies a choice. And in that choice lies your freedom. And if you can really appreciate, assimilate, and implement those words of wisdom, I think it would serve you so well on, you know, day-to-day interactions, not only with your loved ones, but friends and colleagues, and in every kind of walk of life. So I think first is learning to recognize that. How do I bring the temperature of the room down and first begin with yourself? Second, I do think that it is important to recognize we all have biases, some overt, some unconscious or implicit. And to your point about that, approaching life in general with curiosity and compassion, learn more about them. Really try to unpack that yourself. There are implicit association tests online. I'm always disheartened to ascertain what my own are. But as good friends of mine, Dr. Rob Roswell and Quinn Quapers and others have taught me, it is possible to learn debiasing strategies. But the first step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. And then the third thing, first seek to understand, then be understood. That's not one of my rules. That's obviously from Stephen Covey and probably from others as well. But again, much harder to implement in practice, but I truly believe effective leaders speak last. And if you can really learn how best to engage others, involve them, and truly try to understand, then I think that that's how we have better conversations, better resolution of where we see, you know, conflict, both perceived and real.
Yeah, no, again, beautifully, beautifully said, and thanks for those quotes. Shashank, we, you know, final few minutes for the podcast, and I wanted to ask you about a couple more concepts, you know, which I think are relevant for physicians, you know, cardiologists, you know, certainly educators across the spectrum. You know, one is describe to the listenership, and I know we've had conversations about this, and I think different people want to pursue leadership positions for different motivations in life. And I know that, you know, we've resonated, both you and I have resonated on the concept of servant leadership. And I want to hear from you, you know, share your thought process on what do you think, and I'm sure people have heard this term before, like servant leadership. What does that mean to you? What does servant leadership mean to you?
Well, I it's one of the few like terminology that is almost self-evident, right? it truly means to adopt a leadership practice and philosophy that prioritizes the well-being of others, right? And serving others. And I think you might say that it's a tautology. Isn't that the goal of all leadership? But I think the key aspects, you know, of a servant leader is to do the things that we have discussed, which is to listen actively, to have an open mind, to accept others for who they are as they are, to have some self-awareness. Tasha Urich's work has done a phenomenal job of shedding light. You know, 80 to 90% of people think they're self-aware, but 10 to 15% actually are. And I ask myself every day, which camp am I in and how do I know? The ability to adapt, the ability to set a vision, the ability to sort of empower others. You know, I think this is all part of the eulogy virtues. If we ask ourselves how we wish to be remembered, and what this experience and other, you know, leadership development programs have taught me is you've got to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. And so how do you turn leadership into not just, a program, or a set of principles, but really as, and not just a singular act, but like a habit. And that means something that you do to help hone that craft on a day-to-day basis. For me, it includes a weekly reflection practice, a daily gratitude ritual. But I know for many others, it involves journaling and writing, and a variety of other, you know, potential strategies that we haven't even touched the surface on today. But I think it embraces the spirit by which I choose to live my life. I know it's one that you embrace as well, and you know, ultimately that is why we're all here, is to truly serve others. You know, Martin Luther King, another hero of mine, I think stated it best among his many quotes, which is, "Life's most pressing and urgent question is, what are you doing to help others?" And so I try to really meditate on that question, not just from a CV standpoint, but truly from a virtuous standpoint. What are we actually doing to help others?
Beautifully said and eloquently put. I think it's, I think of, you know, for me personally, as much as I enjoy updating and putting my CV together, I think I've come to a point in life where I think some of the most beautiful things that I'd like to think I've accomplished have been anonymous and have you know, really filled my soul not something that I need to put on my CV or, you know, advertise. And but and you know, you probably know what I'm talking about, as we discussed. And you know, and those are the kinds of acts, and those are the kinds of endeavors and projects that have provided me, you know, the most meaning in life. You know, quite frankly. No, this has been such a fascinating conversation, Shashank. I want to thank you so much for your time. I would like to request final few words from you, you know, both for the listenership as well as for Parallax. And, you know, I want to thank you again for sparing your time. I know how busy you are, you know, as a young father, a busy clinician, an entrenched mentor, you know, having firsthand actually met your mentees and, you know, how much they like you and revere you. So thank you. Really thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing this for us. And I'd like to close this episode with a final few words from you on A, Parallax, and B, for the listenership.
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Dr. Kalrai. It's really been an honor and a privilege to spend, you know, this time with you and to learn from you and to co-author this with you. I think I don't have any words of wisdom that we haven't already sort of explored or discussed with our listenership, other than to state that it will always appear that these times are challenging, are complex, and it's in the crucible of crisis that true character is revealed. That's something that both of my parents really instilled in me, and I think that it's incumbent upon all of us to try to seek the best in others and to bring out the best in ourselves, so that we can make again a more perfect union. And if so, isn't that the world that we really want for our children and our posterity? And as a newly minted father, that's something I think deeply about on a day-to-day basis. So thank you again for the honor and privilege.
Oh, no, pleasure is all ours. And, you know, thanks for everyone who's tuned in to listen to Parallax now into its season 6. I've really enjoyed having these conversations with luminaries like Dr. Sinha, who have, you know, shared their time and their wisdom with the listenership. You know, as always, we take your feedback very seriously. So do share and like our episodes and help spread the word. Do write to us. You know, I review all written feedback and, you know, try to incorporate whatever you want from us, you know, as hosts of this platform. You know, do drop us a review on Apple Podcasts and SoundCloud and Spotify. They help us a lot. So with that, thanks everyone for tuning in. And until another Monday, see you soon. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast produced by Radcliffe Cardiology in association with MakeADent.org. We aim to bring you a new angle of all things cardiology every second week. Review us on your favorite podcast app or send your comments or questions to podcast@radcliffe-group.com. To view the series, head to radcliffecardiology.com/podcasts/parallax. Thanks for listening.